The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
So honored to have Denise Harley on the line. Denise is an attorney with a group that we so respect at The Shepherd. This is the group that is called Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF. And they are defending freedoms in so many ways across the country with so many important issues. And Denise, I'd like to say, first of all, welcome to my program.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be talking with you today.
You know, the fact is you spent time in our good state. Tell us about that.
I sure did. I'm a native Floridian, born and raised in Tallahassee as a sixth generation of Tallahassean. And I'm a proud graduate of Florida State. And I also worked at the Florida Supreme Court for Justice Ricky Polston after law school. And then I also served as Deputy Solicitor General for the state of Florida under Attorney General Pam Bondi. And my heart is always will be there in Florida as my home state.
Oh, that's great. And it's fun to talk to people who, you know, grew up in our state and had these experiences working for the great office that you did. And my friends in Gainesville will forgive you for being from FSU.
That's, I hope so.
They do. That's always been a lot of fun for me. I moved to Gainesville in 2002 from Orlando and was there for 17 years. And three of my four kids graduated during that time from UF. So we are Gators, but we're just going to be examples here of how great Seminoles and Gators can get along on important
United
issues.
United in Christ. That's right.
That's right. How did you come to know the Lord?
Well, I was blessed to be born into a family that elevated the name of Jesus Christ. And from birth, I was just surrounded by parents and cousins and aunts and uncles. And we loved the Lord. And I was taught to worship Him. And we were part of the local church. And that was truly our only priority in life. It's funny, I think back and I go, I don't even know what my relatives did for work or if they went to college or really anything about them. I just know we all love Jesus. And so I was just infused with that sort of rich heritage. And that is, of course, just a blessing from God to just abundantly love me in that way.
That is such a great heritage. And you know, that is a wonderful proof that the way parents live has a major impact, not only in their lives, but on the lives of their kids as well.
Yes, amen. And as a parent of a two-year-old and a nine-month-old, I'm continually reminding myself of that, even though I think, you know, they don't understand what I'm saying. They do, and it really matters.
It does, and it will bear fruit. And thank God for parents like what you had that lives it out and talks about it and makes living for Jesus such a normal and really wonderful way to live. There's nothing better than that. And I just congratulate you, Denise, and your parents, and so thankful that you're doing such a work as you are. And I want to get right to it because I know our time is limited with you today, but you're serving again with ADF, the Alliance for Defending Freedom, and this organization works so tirelessly, as we said, to defend both people who are fighting particular battles as well as the bigger, more general issues. And one of the things that you have been working on and are going to talk about today would be the whole issue that we hear about, and it's so hard to believe how much ground has now been given over to this issue of transgenderism. And it just seems like this word became, I guess, I hate to use the word popular, but well-known. It's not popular. It's well-known, though, in our culture now, when just such a few years ago, no one would have believed that when you're filling out a form, the issue of your gender would be in question, or this whole thing of dysphoria. And now the president that has come into power in just a few short weeks ago has made several directives that has really those directives have affected this issue. And share a little bit about how in particular they are touching on this.
Well, on day one, President Biden implemented an executive order that really guts legal protections for girls and women. It's a very sweeping executive order that your listeners probably have heard about. And it uses very broad language to essentially say that in no public facility, place, school, sports, anything with public funding, there can be no what's called discrimination based on gender identity, which what we know that means that boys now will have equal access and equal opportunity to be competing in girls' sports, using bathrooms and locker room facilities, potentially scholarships, dormitories. It's really the ramifications are unknown to ignore the biological differences between male and female. And so at this point, we're just watching and waiting and getting ready to commence legal action as soon as we see anything unconstitutional starting to happen.
Well, you know, with that, the two things come quickly to my mind, Denise. Number one, the percentage of our citizens in America that would identify as being transgender, unless I am mistaken, it's a minuscule percentage. Isn't that true?
And at the same time, 50% or more of our population are girls and women. And so, you know, I think a lot of us were really hopeful that President Biden would come in and stand by his promise to be about unity. And I mean, I'm still hopeful and praying for that. But it is very concerning to see such an extreme executive order out of the gates that is going to gut 50 years of progress that girls and women have had under Title IX. In fact, it completely would nullify all of the positive effects of Title IX, which allows for girls to have equal educational opportunities to boys. Mm-hmm. And that means scholarships, participation in sports, which is so good for self-confidence and even career development and just the camaraderie and the discipline. I mean, there's so many intangible benefits. But if girls know that they're going to lose before they even start the game, right, or start the race, they're going to end up being on the sidelines in their own sports. And mm-hmm. that's really disheartening.
And we know that there are certain areas where strength matters. Biological strength differences are there. God made us different, and he made them male and female, not binary genders. That was never there. That's never been part of the discussion. It's never been part of American history. And yet, as one person on the day after that was signed, I heard one newscaster express it this way. They said, with one strike of the pen, President Biden has decimated women's sports. And, you know, that's just an amazing statement, but just almost overnight. And then I mentioned a couple of things. The second thing that so amazes me about it is that the makeup of our government right now is such that such a big decision, I understand executive orders and their place, but such a big decision that has ramifications unknown, like you said, and they certainly immediately affect everybody. This was done without due course of discussion. This was done without due course of objection. And yet here we are, and we're dealing with it. So what are the people at ADF thinking might be a scenario that we're going to see played out as the days come on?
So one place we expect to see this playing out really soon is in some of our ongoing litigation involving female athletes who are being forced to compete against biological boys who identify as girls. So we have a case in Connecticut representing four female track athletes in high school who are excellent runners, very hard workers, and they are near the top of their field. But a couple of years ago, two boys decided they identified as girls and wanted to compete in the girls division, and they came in and absolutely dominated, and they took first and second in almost every single event statewide, and have stripped these girls of titles that had been won over the course of 20-30 years. The boys just demolished the records. Mm-hmm. And so unfortunately, you know, now we expect for the Biden Department of Justice and Department of Education to come in on the wrong side of this. Previously, we had the support of the administration. They were on our side in briefing. they were recognizing the biological differences of male and female and how important that is. And now we're very concerned that we're going to see in our court case the Biden administration coming on the other side against us in support of the boys that identify as girls.
And it does affect, and it looks like you said, after a while, I think the percentage of this is so small. And I think that looking at it from the different side, the percentage of people who say, this isn't right, we're not going to support this, we're going to stop supporting women's sports, we're going to stop attending these games. And we all know, I mean, it's sad, we had some dear friends some young ladies that were part of the women's sports department at UF when we lived in Gainesville. And there's no doubt about it that the difference in those that follow women's sports, even as they are today and as good as they are, it's much less than other sports that would be, let's say, basketball or men's football, football in the men's side. But that percentage of attendance, that percentage of support, it's only going to go down as people see this disparity happen. And they're going, this isn't right. These aren't any longer biological ladies competing against each other. These are men dressed up like ladies. And we're being forced to almost accept this and act like, yeah, that's normal, right? It's not.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see girls and young women going over to the men's division and trying to compete, because everyone understands biology is not bigotry. And somehow it's gone from basic science to some sort of, you know, bigotry or discrimination in the course of just a few years. And it's really wrong. It's a complicated issue. We, you know, I'm sure you also share the grief and you pray for those who struggle with issues of gender identity, which I'm sure is a very difficult thing for an adolescent. But the solution can't be a compromise that strips the freedom and privacy rights of girls and women across the nation. Whatever sort of solution you want to have for that can't be something that, you know, denies reality. The fact that a man's belief about his gender doesn't erase all of his physical advantages.
You know, I heard a long time ago at a friend who spoke at a meeting, and he used this expression, and I've never forgotten it. He said, sometimes to deal with a problem like a mosquito, people pull out a 2-megaton bomb. And, you know, you don't need a 2-megaton bomb mm-hmm. to destroy a mosquito. And yet that's exactly what it seems like has been unleashed upon us on this problem. We have made, along with trying to address this issue of that they're addressing, unleashed a whole bunch of new problems and new issues that are just mind-boggling to me. Denise, as the days come forward, I know you said that ADF is watching these court cases like the one in Connecticut. What along with this would they believe these other directives? What do you anticipate being the next course that this administration will do? Have you got any ideas on that?
Well, and just to be clear, we are lead counsel in that case, defending these girls, and it arose out of a problem because of a local Connecticut policy. So if we've seen these problems just at the local level, and we're just imagine what we're going to see if it's a federal national mandate from the president. But to answer your question directly, the executive order directs the federal agencies and departments to come up with specific policies to implement this so-called anti-discrimination order. And so, you know, we really don't know what the bureaucrats are going to come up with or who necessarily is even staffed in these agencies that are going to be deciding this policy. One thing we are watching and concerned about is the impact on public accommodations, places like battered women's shelters. We had to litigate a case in Alaska when they had a bad law in Anchorage that allowed men identifying as women to come into women's shelters and sleep alongside women who had been sex trafficked and raped. Mm. And it was a homeless man who said he identified as a woman and was dressed in a nightgown. And the city came after this homeless shelter to try to force them to accommodate this. And it was wrong. Praise the Lord, we won that case in federal district court. But if this is a national policy coming down from the White House, we can expect litigation like that across the country.
When this happens, when an executive order from the president like this happens, and again, there's been no Congress, there's been no voting, there's been no debate, would states' rights be able to stand up to that and say, no, we're not going to do that in this state or this state?
Well, we've seen that. It's really interesting who's on the side of which side of the issue, because under the Trump administration, you probably recall, California was suing him all the time. And the Obama administration, Texas was suing him all the time, and, you know, other states as well. And so, yes, I think anything that's pretending to be a law that's simply done with a president signing a piece of paper without any sort of democratic process is extremely vulnerable. And so I want your listeners to be encouraged just to know there are a lot of lawyers out there who care very much about religious freedom, constitutional rights, free speech, protecting marriage and family. And we are vigilant, and we are resourced, and we are praying, and we are going to be ready to fight this and defend everyone's rights the best we can.
Well, I so appreciate Alliance Defending Freedom, the work you do, and the heart that you have. Thank you, Denise. This is Denise Harley, and she is with ADF and working hard on the rights of these people whose rights have been just in a single moment struck and seemingly taken away. And we're believing God that more success and court cases will turn these things over as the days unfold. Denise Harley, thank you for being with me today.
Thanks, Mike. Great talking with you.
All right. God bless you. And friends, I'll be back in just a moment. And welcome once again to my program, Afternoons with Mike. Such a joy to be here with a guy that I met several months ago. He is from Orlando, and he is a director of the communications department, all of the AV issues that a large church like First Baptist Orlando is involved in. I'll let him tell you even more about his job description, but Dana Meeks is here. I got to know Dana through the fact that they have a radio program right here on The Shepherd in Orlando, and it is so exciting. Comes on every Sunday afternoon at 1:05, and we get to hear the messages from Pastor David Youth and all of the other wonderful things that are going on down at First Baptist, one of the area's largest churches. And so welcome, Dana Meeks.
Mike, thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you've got this wonderful voice. you do voice work.
I do
that as well. You're a producer. How did you, Dana, get to know the Lord in the beginning?
Well, I was brought to church actually from my parents. They were religious folks, and I grew up in Indiana. So from a young age, I think I was around 8 when they actually got me involved into the children's programs at church and the youth groups. And back then, not to date myself too much, but it was an evolution that was happening in the church. We called it Sunday school, but it evolved during my time in church to be more of a youth-based principle, a lot which is actually very strong now in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, to talk about me as far as my career a little bit, I was one of these weird individuals that I actually knew what I wanted to do at 14 years old.
That doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't. And to actually do it. So I wanted to be an audio engineer at the age of 14. And my mother was a choral director at a large high school, and she had some equipment, and there was a guy that came in to help her set it up for the first time, and I was the student. So that was my first time of actually getting on a console was for that. And I lead into that, which made me aware of what I wanted to do even more. And the church allowed me to get involved in the technical department there as a volunteer, which I did a lot of through the years. Before contemporary Christian bands were actually called contemporary Christian bands.
I was one of the players in one of those kinds of bands.
Were you really?
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
It was about 1980-81, and a band formed at the contemporary church that I volunteered and called it my congregation. And so we went out in a 4 or 5 state area. We were actually quite busy and toured. We did prison ministry. We did colleges. We did other small churches that wanted to have that type of new entertainment come out to them. I got my teeth cut a lot on that.
Yeah.
When you go to different venues. And actually,
So you were the sound guy with the group.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, it's so true. And sound people don't always get the attention, except when something's going wrong.
You get that look
like, fix it, please. I understand that completely. But people don't realize how critical, even in that time of transition, when bands were, like you said, getting transitioned and no longer being called gospel, but being called contemporary Christian. You and what you did was a main part of making a service like that happen. And a lot of people don't realize that the sound operator, the guy that's mixing what people are hearing, is a critical component.
And very subjectionable as well. It's one of those types of businesses that, positions, I should say, that everybody could have their own opinion mm-hmm. on how it should be. But like you said, it's one of those positions, everything's okay until it goes wrong.
Until it's not okay. That's right.
It was a good learning experience for me, though. And I look back on those. You know, when you go through those times in your life, you don't really know what an impact it made on you mm-hmm. until later in life. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those situations where I look back and I thank God that he placed me in that position, which helped me learn a lot today.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm one of those individuals where I took 9 years of piano, played trumpet for 7 years, but ask me today if I ever sit down and play.
Oh, shame on you.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm too busy doing the other end to worry about the creation of the music.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's, you know, again, everyone has their giftings and everyone has to make a decision how they're going to spend their time with what they love to do.
Absolutely.
And you're one of these guys that you're doing what you love to do still to this day. Now, going back to your story about it, age 14, I'm immediately inquisitive as to what kind of gear it was at age 14 that you were operating that made you think, I want to do this for my living.
Well, equipment-wise, if I can scratch the cobwebs out of my brain, it was actually the first console I ever utilized was a Yamaha. It was, and I don't know, remember the model number, I'm so sorry.
And this is a sound console.
Yeah.
Just a basic, like what people would have in a church building.
Yes, absolutely. Had a cover that hinged on the top of it so you could carry it around. And I remember hooking it up to the famous Shure VocalMaster tower speakers.
Oh, absolutely. I had some of our band used a Shure VocalMaster, and we had the little head, the six-channel head that went with those tower speakers.
Yep.
You remember that?
Yes, I do.
You remember how when you would bump it, the spring reverb would...
Yes. Which actually, the next console that I had, actually toured with, had that spring reverb. It was a PV. And
oh, yeah.
If you hit the console, it sounded like a thunderbolt going off. It was quite astonishing.
That is too funny. Yeah, we traveled around. And so when you were doing sound back in the day, did you have the whole modern kind of setup where you'd have a snake and you would stretch all the way back to... The mix point being at the back of the auditorium?
Yes, we were actually quite modern that way back then. We had a snake, a console. We had a three-way Triamped speaker system. We had a wedge monitor system. Ears weren't really popular back then. And we were running about 24 channels input for a little band.
That was big.
It was big back then.
Yeah, it was.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, were you guys loud? That would be the question that a lot of our listeners would be asking.
You know.
This sounds loud.
It was at times. We had to basically form ourselves depending on the venue that we were at. Sometimes when you were playing for the Bridge Club, you had to tone it down. But then when you went for, you know, the younger generation, so to speak, or the college crowd, they were more than happy to mm-hmm. bring up the decibels and rock on.
Oh, I tell you what, I had an experience in the 80s like that where I brought in a nationally known, and I'm not going to give the guy's name, a nationally known artist who, once we got to talking with him, I realized he had lost a lot of his hearing. And he demanded the sound be very, very high in terms of decibels, just so he could hear. And he played an instrument. Again, not going to share which instrument because all of that would
give it away.
Give it away.
Yes.
And Well, it was so loud that I'm pretty sure people in the next county got saved that night. I'm pretty sure. The message went out. Oh, my word. I almost lost my position in the church.
How long was it before he actually let on that that was the situation to him, that he was hard of hearing? Did he ever?
No, never.
Just turned it up.
Yeah. And it had it was bad. It was blistering and one of those kinds of sound. You know, people don't realize that when they're talking about sound, it can be very, very difficult days later if you're in an auditorium where it's too hot. But, you know, there's a science for what you do. And are you involved in the Sunday sound of your main service? Is that part of your purview?
Yes. Interestingly, when I went to school, I thought I was going to be more into the music end of this business. But as God had planned for me, I went more in the post-production side. So before I actually worked for the church, I was worked for post-production studios secularly. Mm-hmm. And I cut my teeth in the studio doing sound for picture.
Okay.
Movies,
that's got to be cool.
Television
yeah.
shows. It was. And it's I kind of stuck with it. And it became my forte, so to speak, actually, even over music. But yes, I'm in the broadcast department. So there's somebody else that's handling the front of house and the staging and the monitors. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. all a different position. But I'm actually the broadcast engineer.
Okay. Because you guys are, it's a big operation there.
It's a small city. Yes.
Yeah. It's a small city and a big city. And most churches would really be possibly at the point of being overwhelmed when you go in. I know with as much as I've done in churches, when I walked into First Baptist Auditorium last year for the first time in years, moving back to Orlando, I just for a moment I went, "Wow,
it is overwhelming at first.
This is like being in a major hall in some big auditorium in some major." Well, of course, Orlando is a major city, and yours is a major auditorium, and it is beautiful. Seating, does it still seat around 5? Is that what it does?
Yeah, when we renovated, I believe 6.5 years ago, and we took the pews out at that time and went stadium seating, so it did cut that down to, I think, we're around 4,300 now with that change.
4,300 seats available in this auditorium, and yeah, it does. It looks like it has its own zip code. It's big, but the people there make it feel small. And that's the wonderful thing that I love about going. And every time I'm there, regardless if I'm in Faith Hall or whether I'm in the main auditorium, whether I'm talking to people who are involved in the displays at conferences who are serving there. Every time I'm at First Baptist, it's some of the friendliest people I've ever been around.
That's a great testament to hear, especially for our church and our people. And I really appreciate that compliment. But as much as it is a compliment, I have to agree with you. And I know that probably sounds like a biased opinion coming from me since I work there. But it is. It's amazing how small we can make that big campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way that we do that is really focus on people. We focus on brokenness. We focus on needs or where someone might spiritually need to end up in their lives or where they're maybe missing that spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
We like to try to connect with people one-on-one and bring them to Jesus in that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's working. And every time I'm there, I've had marvelous times. And some of the things I've been there are occasions like when R.C. Sproul would hold his conference, I would be there.
Were there at that?
I was.
Interesting.
I've been there a couple of times, actually, for conferences, and really can say that I heard one of what I consider to be the top 5 messages in my life was right there inside that building when R.C. Sproul spoke one night there. And it was a barn burner, man. I tell you, it was an afternoon, actually. It was an afternoon session.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Danny Jones and I were listening to it together. We could hardly move at the end of it. I mean, it was difficult to get up and go to the next session.
Yeah.
It was like, I just need to sit here and worship a little bit.
We've been very fortunate to host that conference throughout the years. There's only been a few years that we did not do that. Happy to say they will be back again this March.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an international conference, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you're correct. When R.C., the late R.C. Sproul now, sorry to say, would speak, it was definitely one of the pinnacles of that conference. The biblical knowledge that those folks have baffles even me. I sit back there and go, wait, whatty hooty, huh? Wow, that's amazing. So, yeah,
yeah.
It's very, very interesting. It's
a
great conference to attend, either working or being there as a guest.
You know, you coming to the Lord as you did at such a young age and growing up, and a couple of times you've used this phrase, which I love, you cut your teeth. You've cut your teeth on the gospel, and you've cut your teeth in church. And, you know, we're living in a culture right now where more and more, it seems, sadly, really don't have a good concept at all, much less any experience personally. I'll never forget, Dana, sitting and talking one time when I was in television. I was a TV weather guy and had met a young lady that was there, and she was one of our co-anchors on the show, and I'm having a conversation with her because she was new to the city, and we were still talking about acclimating to our area there in southern Indiana, by the way, in Evansville.
Okay.
And I found out in this process that she had never, I mentioned something like Moses in just an illustration about saying something,
mm-hmm.
and she had no idea who I was talking about. So I go and I said, well, you know, Moses from the Bible, you know, Moses and, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, the plagues.
Yes.
She had heard none of those stories.
And she was from that area?
No. She was from some other area in the country, had moved to our area, a very secular family, had never once attended a church service, and had never heard the story of Moses in the Bible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Isn't that unbelievable?
And that was 20, 30 years ago. And sadly, there are many today that haven't. And we just have to be evangelists in our heart, man. We have to realize that there are people around us that we're going to Publix with or next to, and we bump into them and maybe at the car dealership when we're having our car worked on or whatever. And these people do not know the Lord.
And it starts at home.
Mm-hmm.
It starts at home with your children and family members that may marry into your family. And like you just said, there are people who don't have that opportunity with their family. So no one has ever introduced them to the Lord. And taking that opportunity to do so can be a very moving experience. I think, though, it starts with family. If you're never introduced to it, you just kind of shy away from it. It doesn't become part of your life.
Well, and just to commend your mom and dad who raised you, and even hearing the story about your mother's involvement in this, even getting sound equipment for you, you were drawn into the world in which they were involved in, and you came to love that.
I did. It was love at first sight, too. It was, interestingly, learning audio in the church, it was a double hit. You know, it was learning about Jesus and also learning a craft,
mm-hmm.
and being involved and feeling like you're serving to perform that task for somebody else,
yeah.
to be able to enjoy a service, a concert, music, whatever it may be that you're supporting audibly. You just feel like it's part of your mission. And that's really how I feel today.
Oh, it's wonderful. It just really does go along with that saying that more is caught than taught.
Absolutely.
And man,
that's great.
You caught it.
That's great.
You caught it from your parents. And what a wonderful thing. Dana Meeks is my guest, and I'll be right back. This is Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. In the studio with me today is Dana Meeks. Dana directs. What is your exact title down there at First Baptist?
Yeah, actually, my title is just basically I am an audio engineer for broadcast and post-production.
Wow, that is cool. And, you know, you guys do a lot. First Baptist is one of those churches that is huge. Many would refer to it as a mega church. I don't like that kind of a connotation always because in saying that, many churches around the country that do cater to a lot of people, have a big auditorium. They really are more of a teaching center or a ministry center than they are a church. And that is not the true for First Baptist. You may have a large auditorium, but there's a lot of time. There is a lot of effort that I know goes into the fact that you've made this, like you said in segment one, this large church much smaller and much more intimate. And the kind of relationships, I spent some time with Danny down there one time. Oh my gosh, what a great guy he is. And
he is. We're blessed to have him.
Yeah, Danny DeArmas and his just heart for God. And Pastor Youth is such an approachable guy. And even before David got there, Jim Henry, his involvement, he was on my show several months back, had the time of my life talking to that man. And
Mr. Humble.
Oh, that's just what I started to say. This man, this humble heart, he's accompanied the president of the United States.
Yes.
And yet he is as down to earth as anybody you would ever, ever talk to.
Absolutely.
I look forward to having him back on my show soon. But going back down to what you're doing now, and, you know, I think, Dana, you working in broadcasting, you would have had no way of knowing 1 year ago that this country was going to get hit with a scenario that forced not just big churches, but forced just about every church into the need to do this new term that we all became comfortable with called live streaming.
Yep.
And suddenly now, every church was in need of a Dana Meeks.
That's true. And interestingly that you introduced this, years ago, when I first walked into my room, they were attempting to stream on a very antiquated computer and doing it through their own pipeline there at church. And I didn't know anything about it, but I said, this can't be working correctly, and of which it did not. We couldn't handle the pipeline that was going out. We couldn't handle the bandwidth of the viewership of it. Even back then, that was 15 years ago. Come today, I also manage all of the online scheduling and the business between the CDN, the content delivery network that we use, and us as a church. So besides doing audio, I also handle all of that scheduling and the business that goes on with that campus-wide. Interestingly, where we were, fortunately, that a lot of churches were not, were exactly as you explained. They had to learn about this concept and this procedure of taking and capturing what they're doing in a room and presenting it online. We were already there. We were already doing it. Obviously, we had to step it up a little bit because we had other ministries within our church, Horizon West, which is a sister church out in the Independence area, and the Spanish ministry there. They came back into it and they needed production done so that they could continue their ministry as well. So we took, as we were speaking, taking a large church and making it small, we actually took the stage and chopped it down to look more like a television studio and moved the cameras 60 feet up towards the stage so that it was more of a television studio environment than a worship center at that point.
Yeah, because there's no advantage in showing empty seats in front of you. And that's not only kind of visually disturbing, I believe, because it would have been reminiscent of this lockdown and really just the sad condition that we all found. And I'm so glad, and I pray that we never have to get back into that again, because that's a very distressing time. And as John Stimberger, one of my friends here, said, you know, you can be into Eastern religions and set and have nirvana all by yourself on a hillside, but Christianity does not work the same way. We need each other. Mm-hmm. We need fellowship.
Absolutely.
We need, and the fact the Bible says, do not neglect the assembling together, and the key word in that, the assembling together, that means, face-to-face in one building. We need that in our life.
Absolutely. And now, during this time, this past year, we've had to depend on reaching out through the internet, through different platforms. We stream on three. Our website, Facebook, and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
We do all of that simultaneously so that no matter where you are, hopefully you can get onto one of those platforms and do that. But what kind of, and I say kind of because obviously not everybody does it well, we kept the assembly part of your discussion to chat rooms, being able to use a complimentary program called Church Online and attach that to the website in order to allow people to chat real time and to discuss where they're from, what they're doing, if they have a prayer request. And currently we're taking that even further right now. We have just recently utilized a pastor for online services only.
Wow. No, I have not heard about that. That is a great concept. So basically now you've got someone overseeing and giving the spiritual edge, the spiritual component mixed in there as well.
Yeah, he's going to be more or less the producer of what happens online. So he'll be the go-to guy about programming, about when we do things, extracurricular things that we might offer online besides just a message on Sunday mornings, programming such as that.
Now, I know that you've been impacted. You are meeting live again on Sundays.
We are.
At First Baptist Orlando. How would you say the percentages compared to post or pre-COVID? What would it look like?
Well, we still follow some basic protocols that the government has, I don't want to say mandated, but suggested. And so we are obviously first things first for everyone's safety. So because of those protocols of every other row, every three seats, I would say probably we're at 50% capacity on Sunday mornings between all three services. Interestingly, by looking at the analytics of our online congregation, that hasn't changed much except for the third service. As a matter of fact, it's increased since COVID.
So you may have grown as a church
in a totally different way.
Wow. And I've heard this not only in the live aspect, but the fact that and this was an unexpected benefit, if we could say it, from live streaming, is that on these two platforms that you mentioned, on Facebook and on YouTube, you have the additional benefit of instead of somebody getting an audio recording of what was done at church and listen back at that, they can actually catch it that evening, Monday, Tuesday, and they go back and they give it another view.
Exactly. It video on demand has given a whole new aspect to religious broadcasting. We live in a I want it now society.
Yeah.
It used to be true. You had to wait for FedEx to get the tape to the station and the station to, you know, broadcast it. Now it's broadcast live. And as soon as we hit stop, the video posts and you can go back and watch any part of that video anytime you want.
Isn't that something?
In addition to those three platforms that we stream to live, by the way, we do it for three different ministries in three languages, Portuguese and Spanish. We also do in their native tongue live as well on campus.
Oh, wow.
Not simultaneously, but there's a little time differences, but they are intertwining with each other. We also are on TV 45 here in town. We have actually been on the air in Central Florida for over 63 years, I believe. I may be wrong on that number, so don't quote me if anybody's listening, but we have been on the air for a long time.
Now, is your TV program live or is it tape delayed?
We do both. We do a live broadcast to TV 45 at 10 a.m. And then we have several slots throughout the week that we have a produced show that we air on there as well.
And of course, you're on The Shepherd. And that is exciting.
It is exciting.
Oh, my goodness. We love having you here. And it's on at 1:05 and it's on Sunday afternoons. And what I like about that, we were so happy to be able to give this time to First Baptist. We're so thankful for you. But when you, regardless of what church you're a part of, if you know of, and if you do know of, then you already know why it's a great deal to be able to listen to David Youth and the other pastors at First Baptist. And you can do that. Listen on the radio on your way home from lunch or from your own service if it's a long service.
Yeah.
You can come back. And they're on at 1:05 to 1:30 every Sunday afternoon. You know, Dana, when you look forward to the next several months, the best guesstimate, if I could just use that word, about this whole virus thing is that the hope, the current hope, best earliest current hope would be sometime in late summer when we might get enough of these vaccines in people that some sense of normality, normalcy returns to, I guess you could say,
whatever that is,
wherever, because this is around the world.
Yeah.
Are you seeing the day come where you're already ramping up for an expected return of people, or is the thought we might live the way we're living right now for another year?
Now, I can say with confidence that the mentality of our church is we're planning as though we're going to get back to where we were. We plan on people being there. The reason I know that we're planning that so much is that we just completed the complete renovation of one of our children's buildings. It just happened to coincide with COVID, unfortunately, but we have a brand new building and we are moving forward on that second building this year. We're really focusing on brightening things up for the children here. We feel that children are our future. They're the future of religion. They're the future of our country. We want to raise children in a godly way. We want families to have that opportunity. So I can say with confidence to your question, we're planning on getting together.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I tell you what, I'm praying that it happens sooner than later. One final question before we run out of time here, and I'd love for this, if I could speak for a moment. For I know there are many churches that are working hard and yet resources are limited and they're trying to get a handle on this live streaming thing, something that you work with. What advice would you give? What technologies have you found that you could point a smaller church that's wanting to get their church service live streamed? What would you point them to?
There's so many different variables, you know, depending on what level that you want to do that at. But I would say, if you are a church that wants to start doing this, you can either A, contact a church such as First Baptist Orlando and talk to the people there, such as myself. I can, if I can't help you and give you ideas with what you might want to do with your position of streaming, there are integration companies out here in the Central Florida that are Jesus-based people. I mean, they may work secularly, but they believe in God. They believe in salvation. They believe in the church. They believe in outreach. And there are many different companies, integration companies, that can help you, talk to you for free, and give you an idea about how you can start that up.
You know, we go out to rural areas, obviously, in the radio, all the way from here to North Florida. And I know that there are listeners who are going like, oh, I wish I had Dana Meeks at our church to help direct some of these things. But that's really nice of you to offer that. So people can get in touch with First Baptist Orlando. And maybe it's as simple as, do you have any recommendations about what kind of camera to buy or what kind of computer that would work the best?
My suggestion, depending on the size of church, I would look into... There's several different smaller types of streaming capabilities that you can get that you don't have to spend a monthly fee to a content delivery network such as we do. We do it for accountability and because of the size of streaming that we do. But again, cameras, woo, boy, that's a way out there question that's so variable.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can go cheap or not cheap.
Our camera bodies were $46,000 a piece. You can go out and get a camera, I would say, for $1,200, $3,000. That would do a really good job.
They won't look like First Baptist, but they'll...
real quickly, the interesting thing and the important thing is lighting.
That's good. Having sufficient lighting. Yeah. It's amazing how that good old-fashioned light...
It means everything.
it does. I tell you what, we're already out of time, but Dana Meeks, what a joy... what a resource you are, not to just to First Baptist, but to us all. And thank you for coming in today and sharing from your life. I go back and I'm still amazed at your statement early on. You knew at 14 what you wanted to do and how good and gracious of God to put that in your heart at such a young age. And what a fulfilling life you will look back on one day and say, you know, God gave me a mission. And I took it.
I already do. And Michael, thank you so much for having me on the show and for having First Baptist on your network. We appreciate you.
Oh, we love it. We love it. That's Dana Meeks from First Baptist Orlando. And give us your website real quick.
Our website is firstorlando.com. And first is spelled out.
F-I-R-S-T. There you go. Dana Meeks, thank you so very much. And friends, don't miss tomorrow's program. With me tomorrow will be Dave Zanotti from the Public Square. And we're going to be talking about this most important article that has come out from Time Magazine. Don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's worth the time. That's tomorrow with Dave Zanotti right here on Afternoons with Mike. Have yourself a great day.